Rest in peace, Danny Costa of Cost, Unexamined, and much more. Noise will always remember you. This is White Centipede Noise Podcast. I'm Oscar Brummel, and today my guest is Ryan O'Connor of the New Mexico-based esoteric noise project Ineffable Slime. Ryan is also a rare bookseller at Alarum Books and vocalist of the hardcore band Royal Drug, whose full length was released by Dada Drumming in 2023. If you're hearing this, you're not accessing the episode through Patreon, and will only be getting the first part of the episode. In order to access full episodes of White Centipede Noise Podcast, you'll need to subscribe at patreon.com/whitecentipedenoise. There you can also get access to WCNTV episodes, the Discord server, and a wide range of bonus noise content. White Centipede Noise Podcast is made possible entirely by Scene support, so if you enjoy it, please consider supporting it by subscribing at patreon.com/whitecentipedenoise. All right, hello, Ryan, and welcome to White Centipede Noise Podcast.
Dude, thank you, Oscar. Pleasure and an honor. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me so early.
Yeah, no sweat. Early bird gets the worm.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we're going to talk about your project, Ineffable Slime, today.
Right on.
Which I have been following and aware of for, I think, maybe since the early days of it.
Yeah.
I received some of your, you know, we traded, I think, and I got some of your earlier stuff. And last year you put out a really good tape on Tribe Tapes called A Roll of the Dice. And then shortly thereafter, I believe, an album called Stalking the Sphinx on a CD on Virtues, which is the label run by Alex Komet of Climax Nile. Which, you know, I kind of knew it was going to be the one. Like I've been a fan and appreciating the product for a long time, and I thought that the tape on Tribe was really, really good. And then I started hearing the samples, I think, from the Virtue CD online. Something about it just told me, like, this is going to be that one that really just – and I think it's a masterpiece. I really think it's really, really excellent.
That's an honor.
One of my favorite things I've heard recently, and you know, I've got it right here. Definitely highest recommendation on this album. I feel like it's, you know, it's a continuation of what I've heard from you before, but what can you tell me about this album that sets it apart from previous work?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, Alex reached out to me on Instagram. We've been following each other for a little bit, and, you know, he just messaged me. He's like, "Hey, you post cool stuff. I got your tapes on Fusty. Do you want to do something for me?" And yeah, I mean, Alex is a legend, let's be real. Like, he's a humble guy, but, like, he's incredible. He's been at it. He's still at it. And I really love Virtues because I think it's very much like his vision, and it's not really playing any games with trends. He's doing really, like, innovative and, like, just kind of obscure artists. So I saw that as the opportunity. Like, okay, I'm going to do a proper album for him. And, you know, we kind of talked back and forth, like, format. And I was like, I've had kind of like a bad run with CD player or tape players lately. Like, they've been eating a lot of stuff. So I was like, let's do a CD, something permanent.
Yeah.
And you know, I had kind of a concept going into it. Like, I kind of had a concept that's pretty early on for, like, what I wanted to do for, like, a proper album.
Mm-hmm.
And what's funny is, like, so, like, I had that all mapped out, like, down to, like, track titles, time, notes, samples to use. But then, like, I went to Washington, D.C. on this work trip, and it, like, completely inverted the concept. I was, like, had this super intense experience there. I've been reading a lot of this. I've been really into, like, paranoid American literature, like, real intense conspiracy theory stuff. And there's this one guy, James Shelby Downard, who wrote, he's most famous for this essay called King Kill 33, which is actually a Marilyn Manson song title. So, like, it's got some cachet in the underground. It's in the, like,
Was the Manson title named after the essay? What era are we talking about in terms of this literature?
So I think this was, like, I want to say, like, late 80s, early 90s. And, it was this, it was an apocalypse culture. So that's kind of how it gained some legs. Then it was later taken out of later editions. But it's basically this like hyper paranoid, symbol laden interpretation of the Kennedy assassination. Mm-hmm. So I was reading this relatively new compilation of his writings called Stalking the Great Whore. So you can kind of see where the influence started. So I'm reading that. I'm getting into this mindset. Previous to that, I had read a book called like Aberration in the Heartland of the Real about Timothy McVeigh, which is just like truly out there. But it really kind of defines this American paranoid canon. And that stuff was really crucial to it. So like I go to D.C. and... You know, D.C., obviously, there's all the, like, Masonic lore about the place. And, you know, I get out at one of the stations and, like, I'm walking around and, like, boom, there's the Iraq embassy with this, like, incredible, like, Babylonian deco architecture. And then I'm walking down a street and it's all gas lamps instead of street lights. And then, like, one of them has, like, a throbbing red window. And then, like, I'm over by the Scientology headquarters of the country. And then I pass a Euro place called the Sacrificial Lamb. And then I have this, like, really uncanny experience where, like, do you ever have someone who, like, acts like they know you? Like, come up to you randomly and be like, hey. You're like, yeah, hey, we know each other. I had one of those experiences with these, like, pretty random people. And it was just so trippy. So I go back to my like hotel room and I'm like walking around by the embassies and there's all kinds of weird stuff going on. Guys in suits ferrying people into like the Monaco embassy. I get back to my hotel and there's like this Beatles collection of memorabilia up from like their appearance on Ed Sullivan because they had stayed at that hotel.
No.
And I kind of like lock eyes with this set list from the Ed Sullivan show, which is like their set list. With like Paul McCartney's like pancake makeup smeared on it. And it was just this like, I was like, whoa, okay. I got something going on here. So like I pretty much went up to my room because we had kind of finished our work for the day and just rewrote the concept and like redid everything. So like I got this one like nation idea that like I pitched to him, but then I was just like, nah, we're doing this.
And you pitched then, to Alex?
Yeah. So he was down with it. And then, you know, I work really like, I would say I need, like, to feel inspired to record, right? Like, I'm not just going to sit down and record. Otherwise, I'm just going to, like, not feel it. You know, I think we've all had that experience where you plug a shaker box into a DOD, then a delay, and you're like, cool, like, harsh noise.
Yeah.
So, started pulling samples together and then just worked on that really fast. I think it was, like, you know, basically, like, May to June. Because I was really trying to wrap it up. Before I went on tour with my hardcore band, I wanted to get them everything and get everything out there. So just kind of worked feverishly on it. And just took a kind of kitchen sink approach and sent it off to him. And I know Alex is the kind of guy who's going to tell you, like, you know, this needs more work or this isn't good. Right. But he was into it day one. So I was like, cool, I think I got something going on here. And then, the rest is, you know, recent history.
Available May 4th, 2024 from Reanimated Miscarriage, Cult 80s and 90s Noisecore reissues, and discography compilations from Gorbage, Minch, Pissed Off Orgasm, Rectal Pus, Stench of Corpse, Suppression, and Ulcerous Phlegm, along with several one-off side projects featuring members of Ass Suck, Drop Dead, Meat Shits, and Spaz, and thought-to-be-lost material from 80s punk proto-noisecore pioneers Sea Monkeys. New shirts, a restock of mixtapes, zines, and Deadbeat at Dawn official merchandise, as well as Trauma Team Publishing's premiere release will also be available in limited quantities. The easiest way to secure copies is by joining the mailing list by writing diseaseofthespirit@gmail.com. The second edition of the Initial Shock Fest will take place on July 6, 2024 in Montreal, featuring Richard Ramirez, The Nausea, Heat Signature, Slime Street, Flat Grey, Skin, Parasite Nurse, Echthros, Deep Grey, Death Glaze, Murmur, Foul, Praxillus Succubus, Come and See, and Splinter Assembly. Advance tickets are available now at initialshock.screamandride.com. An Aftershock matinee will take place the following afternoon, featuring Thin Mountain, Molina, Aaron Altomare, Green Mist, and John Vaughn. Follow Initial Shock MTL on Instagram for regular fest updates, including artist bios and more. Initial Shock is presented by Scream and Writhe and Disaster Sources, sponsored by Factor, Pizza Bouquet, and Untitled Zine.
I understand these things that inspired this album. But what can you say more about the content of the album?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think I'm very much into cult literature, conspiracy theory stuff. Also, big opera fan. So, you know, like we have this amazing opera house up in Santa Fe, open air. So you like go there and you see the desert stretching off into infinity, and you'll be watching a Wagner performance, and there'll be like a lightning storm in the background. So I was trying to achieve some of that, like Sturm und Drang of this thing. So in terms of like content, a lot of it is kind of inspired by things I've been reading. I'm an avid reader. And then
I've gathered
Like, you know, I take a real, like, this is not hella pretentious, right? But like kind of a sculptural approach where it's like, I want to build something and I have like, I know what it's going to look like. And it's like, anytime you got a concept in your head, it's always going to be kind of tricky to like fully realize it into reality. Mm-hmm. But like, I will work on like one sound for a lot of time and then layer that with other things and then see what happens as I add things to that. Also, like, go to a lot of estate sales, that sort of thing. And one thing I love to find is like people's just self-recorded stuff. So like, there's this whole thing from like, you know, around the 40s of people doing like audio letters where they would like record their radio and then start talking and then you know, put some other songs on they like. Yeah. And I like to sort of chop those things up and pull out just little bits. You know, like Julius Albin's a huge like inspiration for me, like Moon Lays Hidden and all that.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
I love what he does with like real small loops and samples, like just one thing that can kind of build up into something much more. So, yeah, I mean, there's like opera on there. There's like radio. There's just noise gear. Chopped up stuff I've downloaded from like just various archives. Like, you know, a good resource they can kind of find out there is like colleges will upload like readings and talks and that sort of thing. And just pulling little bits out that like jumped out to me to kind of run with. So yeah, I mean, I feel like it's got like an arc to it. And I feel like, yeah, what I was going for was trying to evoke that like occult paranoid spirit.
That comes through, I would say, for sure. And I would say each track in itself is quite, has an arc and is quite operatic. But yeah, the album as a whole does as well. And it also doesn't, incorporate several samples of maybe what are opera music, I don't know, or it's classical music of some sort, right?
I was running a lot of that. You know, I'd recently bought a Make Noise Strega off my friend in Denton, Randall Middick, a genius himself. And I love what that can do to like music. I really like dismantling music. I'm not one of those people who's like a purist, like, you know, if I hear any musicality and noise, it's all of a sudden non grata. Right. And I like, you know, that kind of manipulation. So that thing is like a hyper complex delay, basically. It's built off, like, I think a P2399 chip. So it really degrades the sample, chops it up. It's an instrument unto itself, but passing audio through it was a big part of the experimentation on there.
Cool. And the music or the noise itself does have quite a musical sense to it. Like, I almost feel like this could be somewhat classified as, I don't know if you need to classify, but like as more like power electronics or industrial, in the sense that like it has these structured and tonal elements that are really consciously kind of working with each other, not in a necessarily a traditionally harmonic way, but it moves like that. And the sounds aren't just kind of like chaotically bouncing off each other. You know what I mean? Like it has a musical purpose to it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, 'cause like, you know, Jim at Fust, he said the same thing on one of my tapes before. But it was like, harsh noise that power electronics feel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, power electronics means a lot of things to a lot of people.
Right.
But for me, it's more like that sort of MB sound of like really degraded musicality.
Ineffable Slime's most recent CD, Stalking the Sphinx, is now available from Virtues, as well as the new Noralag, the Union of Death LP, and titles from Kate Rissek, Climax Denial, Mott, and many more. Premium level Patreon subscribers get a discount code valid until May 1st. Get your discount code at patreon.com/whitecentipedenoise. Then go to virtueslabel.com to pick up Stalking the Sphinx as well as other fine titles from Virtues.
So you've referenced this pretty quickly, and that's, you know, the esoteric and occult, and that's oftentimes, those terms are oftentimes used in, you know, descriptions. I don't know if that's you writing the descriptions of your work or if those comes from outside, but that is clearly a big part of your entire body of work and the philosophy behind it. What can you tell me? I mean, what do those terms mean, first of all, to you? And, like, for a layman, I mean, I have very, like, cursory knowledge of the occult and things like that. What are your specific interests that you're dealing with? And are these interests, like, research interests? Or are these kind of more, like, spiritual personal interests?
Sure. I mean, to that specific point, yeah, probably a little bit of both. It's something I've been into kind of my whole life. Like, I got into Lovecraft, like, really young. So, and then, like, even, like, gaming. I'm a gamer.
Yeah.
Like Silent Hill. Like, you know, the cult stuff in there. And also just growing up, like, I'm 39. Like, saw the Branch Davidians, that sort of thing. So there's always been, like, a very intense interest in kind of that power of belief. And I think, like, my interpretation of it kind of falls into the world of, like, Alan Moore or Grant Morrison, where it's like fundamentally the applied art of imagination. It's like, if you feed yourself back something enough, what can you do to yourself? So, you know, I've gone from, I think it's something you could be very surface level and aesthetically on forever. Mm-hmm. That's probably healthy. But like, if you start to like a funny thing is people, like, totally rational people will get, like, extremely freaked out by stuff. And it's like, what's freaking you out about it if you're so rational? Yeah. You know, like, a friend of mine found this, like, bottle full of, like teeth and notes and nails down by the Bosque, which is a river here. And, like, everyone's like, you gotta destroy it, man. Like, get rid of it. It's bringing a demon into your house. Like, people are, like, totally, like, you know, normie. And but, like, that's the power it has, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think one way that you can use it, right, is just, like, you meditate on stuff. Like, meditation, big part of it, I think.
Yeah.
Like, Aleister Crowley talks a lot about that in book 4, which is just, like, massive tome mm-hmm. that I recommend if you want to go, like, deeper into it. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, like, you know, you retract, you meditate, and then, you know, the Buddhist conception of meditation, you're clearing your mind, you're emptying it, and you're letting it sort itself out. I think the occult or left-hand path or whatever you want to call it is you clear your mind, then you start feeding something into it and see what comes out of there. So I think for a long time, you can be very surface level with it, very much into the imagery. But, like, you know, how many times can you look at, like, the Kabbalah or, like, the Tree of Life without actually being like, let me try to understand that a little more.
Yeah.
So I think, like grimoires and, like, magical texts, are they a fascinating read? Because it's a genre unto itself. They're weird. And I think people are, like, legitimately, like, afraid to read those. But you read them, and it's just, like, these intense directions on how to do something. And you're like, well, obviously someone was trying to do something and had some effect to the point where, like, they put it to text and it's passed through time.
Right.
So I think the tipping point for me was when I moved to Olympia, Washington, because that is, like, a esoteric town. Like, there is, like, the Druid's Nook, like, bookstore, since gone. And then there's this whole thing with, like, the black houses, which I'm sure some people are like, oh, no, don't talk anything about it. But there's,
right.
Like, you're aware of it. The idea is, like, you know, it's a little bit of folklore, but there is a guy there who's, like, a landlord who's got these, like, apartment buildings and has an amazing, amazing bar called Cryptotropa.
Right.
And they're, like, painted jet black. And the idea is, like, they form, like, a pentagram on a map or something, you know. I don't really think that's the case. But, you know, I connected with people out there who were really into this stuff. And some of them, like, a little too much. Like, they, you know, had fried themselves and then kind of come out on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, I began to really study it, got more into meditation, the idea of a practice, the idea of feeding input in and then having something come out. And I think for me, like, practically, in terms of, like, creating, it can almost serve as, like, a way to sort of induce inspiration. Because, like, you know, it's hard to just be like, someone hits you up like, hey, you recorded me a tape, and you're just like, about what? Like, what am I gonna do?
Right.
But like, for me, I want to feel like something's got to get pulled out of my head. And so I think it was effective in kind of building that practice.
So this is something you actively practice?
For a long time, primarily when I was in Olympia, because like when you're like submerged in like a milieu of that thing, it's a lot easier.
Yeah. Sure.
So like, you know, I was getting up to like an hour a day of meditation, like early morning, and then, you know, just really studying the texts and that sort of thing. You know, like just practically speaking, we moved back to New Mexico in 2019. At that point, life comes first. If it doesn't, then you're in trouble, right? Like if you're just meditating and your bills are piling up and you're getting like an eviction notice nailed to your door, that's not an ideal use of this.
Right.
So I've kind of extracted myself to a degree, but I still know how to get there. You know, I'll go there occasionally.
What are some specific like philosophies or teachings or strains, whatever, that you're interested in on a personal level?
Sure. I think, you know, Crowley casts a big shadow over this whole thing, but I think if anything, he's just a really good writer and he's phenomenally prolific. So I absorbed a lot of that. And then you get into stuff like, you know, Jack Parsons and the Lodge in Los Angeles, where basically like Scientology was basically like stolen from him and then like adapted into this weird thing. But for me, like one of the big ones was like kind of John Dee's like Enochian system, which was like this hyper complex, very like hardware based practice that, you know, John Dee was like a court astrologer for Queen Elizabeth, a sort of a phenomenal mathematician, but he also like had this side project where he's like, I'm going to try to build like a specific thing you can do to contact entities outside of oneself. So I got really interested in that because even just visually, it's fascinating. He has these diagrams that look like hyper complex circuit boards and they're just kind of massively complex ciphers. And so like, I am the kind of person, like when I get into something, I go like real deep into it. And that became kind of the anchor. And that's like the one where like, I was experimenting with pretty heavily. I didn't do the whole like his whole system is like, basically like if you build this thing, you wear this, you put this on, you recite this, you're going to make contact with something. But kind of meditating on his ideas and using a lot of it led to some pretty like uncanny experiences, which are like hard to articulate. Cause if you tell someone, they're going to be like, you're kook, you're nuts. Yeah. But like, you know, we all have experiences where like, uncanny weird stuff happens.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like even speaking like you being sick recently, like way back when I first moved to New Mexico, I once was like super sick. I was like crashed out on my couch and I had the skylight over it that was just going straight up. And I put on a Kevin Drum's Imperial Distortion, like full blast. And I, you know, it made me feel like my consciousness was like ascending through that window. It was like an almost out of body experience.
Yeah.
Reality was, I was sick as shit and like hallucinating. But put on like Kevin Drum, and that's gonna help you do something.
Right.
Like that's, you know, it doesn't have to be like you gotta be all in and be like, oh yeah, there's like a demon in this book.
Right.
But you can be like, hey, if I feed these inputs into my brain, I'm going to get something. So like one of the tapes I did for Fusty says like Enochian electronics on it, because like that was kind of the mindset I was in at the time of recording that. And I think also, you know, now that I'm back in New Mexico, like this place has its own otherworldly aspect, like literally Roswell.
Yeah.
It's a cool place to kind of go out into just the wilderness and experience some weird stuff or see some weird stuff. There's so much here that's just like unmapped and unknown.
Yeah.
And it's extremely inspirational for me. It's been really good to be back.
How much interest or how much does this fascination with American paranoia and conspiracy theories and stuff like that translate to like modern day conspiracy theories and paranoia, like post-internet?
I think it's pretty degraded these days. It bums me out. I mean, obviously all that stuff is very hazardous and that it can lead to very terrible assumptions about the world. So, you know, I have a background in like anthropology, so I always try to maintain that, like, I understand why you're doing this, but like, I don't agree with it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, lately, like, and even when I was growing up, like, I think Alex Jones had like a different cachet when you were young. Like I remember seeing the one where he like snuck into Bohemian Grove and was like, I'm like, what the fuck is this? He's in Bohemian Grove, like belly crawling with a VHS recorder, like recording these people and setting an effigy on fire.
Yeah.
Now it's just like, it's so hyper politicized in a way that's like very unappealing to me. I mean, I'm not into that at all.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, periodically things will bubble. I mean, even look at like this Boeing dude who just, you know, shot himself. Like,
right.
Stuff happens. And you know, you should be questioning the official narrative. I mean, other events around the world, which deserve that kind of scrutiny. But yeah, like, I think it does provide a sort of way to scrutinize the world that can be just deeper than kind of the surface level narrative.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because like I've always felt that way, and I've always, you know, there was a time where I've kind of, you know, researched some of the things you're talking about, you know, like I said, pretty cursorily, but like I feel like in the past few years, just because of like the prevalence of like conspiracy theory being kind of like the mainstream, internet like thing, that I'm just like, man, fuck conspiracy theorists, they're so stupid. Like it's not like. The stuff that you're talking about, that's very fascinating, but like the stuff that you see going on right now is just like, even if but at the same time, it's like, yeah, it is important to question the narrative and question the media and question the government. Of course it is. But I feel like that's like been so, it's been like subverted into like the mainstream political tool.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like a fundamental part of like the American Republican Party's platform now in like a completely, in a way that's very harmful, because I feel like there is parallels with how people engage with the occult. Now people engage with conspiracy theories where you can fry yourself. You know, I have friends who are like, I can't talk to anymore because I got injected. You know, I got the vaccine, man. Like I'm persona non grata. I got nanomachines that are going to activate. And yeah, it's like, sorry, dude. Like you took the wrong message from this. And it's amazing how just like rapid fire that spread through a huge part of the population. So you know, what I like in the older stuff is just the examination of symbolism and the examination of architecture, especially, right? Like, why is this thing on this building versus like, why are you harvesting adrenochrome?
Yeah. So what you said about laying down on the couch and, you know, kind of hallucinating to Kevin Drum, I had a question specifically, like, you know, how does noise or music, and in terms specifically noise, like when we're getting to this realm of experimental music, how does that relate to these otherworldly states or these, you know, kind of mystical areas of the mind or the universe for you?
Oh, I think it's like really like pretty intrinsic. Like noise just, it's like buffeting heavy sound that really feels psychoactive in a way. I mean, like, that's what I'm going for. And the best noise shows I've ever been to have been like psychotically loud to the point of feeling like I'm getting blown out of myself. Yeah. Like, I saw Mersbo at Hospital Fest, you know, way back, I think it was 2019 or 2018. Mm-hmm. And I kid you not, it was like such an assault on the senses, because it was just like strobe light, track light, Mersbo shredding. People were just falling on the ground during his set. Granted, it was the end of a long night, but it was like almost like they were getting raptured, you know? Like they were getting knocked into some kind of trance state. And I think, you know, you see that in kind of like repetitive chanting, those sort of things, mantras. Like you just keep a sound going, and then it can really induce something different. A really like fascinating thing that I'll be a little vague about it in New Mexico is there's a like very like noise centric spiritual event that some people in the Catholic faith do. It's called like Las Tinieblas, which means the darkness. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to represent the moment that Christ dies and that he's absent from the world. And there's descriptions of it in, you know, a lot of older books that kind of study this stuff. And I'm sure it's still happening up north, where like, you know, and a whole village piles into a small room lit by a candle. Bunch of dudes walk in with chains, metal boards, these noisemakers that are just, you know, from here, well, I think from Spain, but came here, called matracas, which are kind of like a whirly thing.
Yeah.
And they snuff the candle, and then for like 5 minutes, everyone just goes nuts, screaming, smashing stuff, breaking war boards, you know, whipping chains, spinning these noisemakers, screaming, lamenting. And the candle comes back on, everyone goes silent. And like, that's obviously like, for people who practice that, is like a very important moment. And what it represents, I think, is just fascinating. It's like, you know, it's like, I think Joe Romer was talking about, like, you know, noise is like the primordial chaos. And I mean, to an effect, like, how could it not be, right? It's like the Big Bang, right? Like, that's that started this whole thing off, was a loud-ass sound. And I think we're constantly trying to get back to that. So I feel like, yeah, noise is very spiritual, whether you like it or not, at least in, like, what it can do. You know, I think about, like, back here, like, and also how, like, noise can just, like, kind of, yeah, totally, like, knock you out, right? Like,
yeah.
I have a friend who, you know, got into noise relatively late in Seattle, and he got, like, really into Kjostad and was like, this stuff just makes, like, I put it on when I want to go to bed. Like, it just knocks me to sleep because it's really like someone is, like, cutting off your air supply.
Yeah.
Long before Texas noise icon Keith Brewer dabbled in experimental music, he penned a demented fanzine dedicated to the most depraved films in history. Reanimated Miscarriage is proud to present this 9-issue compilation, taken from original materials, spanning over 80 pages of crude film reviews, serial killer biographies, sick collage art, rare early work from the likes of Mike Diana, and writings on Keith's legacy and influence by Joe Romer. This and 9 Old School Noise Corps reissues, new shirts, and a restock of mixtapes, zines, and Deadbeat at Dawn official merchandise will also be available in limited quantities. The easiest way to secure copies is by joining the mailing list by writing to diseaseofthespirit@gmail.com.
So you mentioned being an avid reader, and, you know, you're, as far as I know, you're a bookseller. I want to talk about what that means specifically. I mean, your Instagram handle is Alarum Books.
Yeah.
Tell me about your relationship to literature a little bit. And, well, let's just start there. Yeah. Tell me about your relationship to literature in general.
Well, I mean, I've been a book collector, avid reader my whole life. I can thank my mom for that. She really, I mean, she's probably the reason I'm into all this stuff. She got me into like The Power of Myth, Joseph Campbell, like those eyewitness books about like phenomena, the ones that come with, like, the Big Black series. So, you know, I'm a seeker after knowledge, man. I like to read stuff, and I like really apocalyptic, spastic fiction, like William Gaddis, J.R. That book is like the equivalent of like being in the stock exchange, like on the subway. Like, it's insane. Thomas Pynchon, Laszlo Krasznahorkai, who I think one of the greatest writers of our time, who actually has like a really good section, one of his more recent books, Baron Wenkheim's Homecoming, which is like vaguely a noise performance described, where it's like 50 Hungarian bikers all trying to play like a Vita off of their motorcycle horns, but they're all playing it slightly off key. So it's just this like buffeting noise show trying to like welcome this guy back to town. But I like when people can really just, I like stuff that just flows. I want like a brick of text.
Yeah.
Like, I'm reading The Death of Virgil right now by Herman Bloch. Amazing book. Wrote it, started it while he was in a concentration camp. And it's following, you know, Virgil from the moment he arrives at a port to his death, and just follows his internal mental narrative. And I think that's what I love in literature, is when like you are pulled into someone, whether it's a character or the author's mind, and kind of experiencing it almost one for one. It's like apocalyptic in like the biblical sense. But yeah, also, you know, being a big book collector, my house is full of books. And so I made the shift kind of to start selling books. About 2022, I had an amazing opportunity to attend the Colorado Antiquarian Book Seminar, which is, anyone will tell you who's gone to it, it'll advance your career like 5 to 10 years. Richard Bishop went to it. He's an amazing bookseller himself. Really, like, kind of the guy who's like, hey, I should do this. Like, I got these books. I should sell them. So I've been selling locally, and then I started the website recently. Reception's been great, and I just like to, I also just like to get stuff into people's hands that I think has some value.
Yeah.
Like I think I want to evangelize for things that I really like and appreciate. So, you know, with authors, it's like great things come and go and they don't get rediscovered till much, much later. So I want to do what I can to kind of put forward the stuff that I like. Cause I'm like, hey, you know, read this now. It'll be inspiring now. And if the author's alive, all the better. Cause I think, you know, we can always sort of come back to someone after they passed and be like, oh, they were a genius. But like, how nice would it be to hear that while you're alive?
How much of what you're selling and what you're dealing with is like from your personal taste and your personal curation?
Almost all of it, honestly. It's like I've been a commuter my whole life, and that's a big part of also, I think, like subtly to my sound and to my tastes, because like I've been like a super commuter since like day one. Like when I was in Jersey working in like Best Buy, I had like a 45-minute bus ride. So
yeah.
I'm always listening to a tape, I'm always listening to a CD, and I'm reading something. And it's awesome to have that part of your day blocked out because you can't really do anything else.
Yeah.
You know, I was working at a bookstore in Jersey City. I had like a train to bus to like bus commute, reading the whole time. I just have so much of it. And like, if I see why something's good, like, I'm not going to sell anything I don't think is good or at least appealing. So like
you're not selling just like stuff that you can sell.
No, I mean, you know, there is usually some balance there, right? Like something sell are very good. But I'm not like going out of my way to find like some, you know, 18th century treatise on like wool making or something. That's not really my thing. Like I do want, and I think this is like, again, with like good booksellers, particularly in the rare and antiquarian world, is you're selling things that like you endorse, you know why it's good, you know why it's important. For what I'm selling, man, I've read like way too much of it, or at least bought it with the intent to read and then sold it later. But yeah, like, you know, if I'm co-signing, it's probably good.
Do you have that kind of relationship with your customers? Like, you know, as a distro, at some point you might have kind of like a people who come to you because they know they can look at your site and know, well, I don't know what this is, but it's new. It looks cool. It's in the shop, or maybe this person recommended it, I should check it out. Do you have the kind of the same?
Yeah. And that's the most edifying part of it, I feel, is like someone coming to you and saying like, yeah, like, what's this about? It looks cool. And then you being able to say like, here's why. Like, actually, I just sold a book to Dan Brigman up in Denver, in Knifey, I think is his project. Super great stuff. This like super obscure, like addiction memoir by a teenager with these like completely insane illustrations in it. And it's the kind of thing you'd pass over most of the time. But I remember I found it in like a thrift shop in Amarillo. And I was like, this has got something. It's actually really well written. So he was like, you know, I'm super interested in this. And then, you know, explained to him what's going on there. And he went with it. There was another one, a book called Just Around the Corner in New Jersey, which is like pretty normal, like a folklore compilation for New Jersey. But it's got these like amazing illustrations by this very obscure fantasy illustrator. And it's like, should be drawing like a dragon fighting a unicorn, but he's drawing pictures of like urban blight with like highly stippled, you know, imagery. And even that alone, like to me, is a selling point. Like, hey, you get these pictures with this book. The content's not great. And I told the person who reached out about that, I was like, so it's whatever, but these pictures are worth it.
Wow. That's a whole new world. I mean, when I think of like underground records or something like that, small editions, how does that compare in terms of like, are we talking about books that were pressed one time, 100 copies or 1,000 copies or
yeah.
How does that
no, work? Yeah. Like a lot of times it is, you know, things will usually increase in value because there was no intent that anyone was going to read it. So, you know, it got run like, you know, a great, great example, Pepsi Cola Addict that David Tibet recently helped reprint. June Allison Gibbons, I believe, is the writer. That was like a private press book that these girls wrote like while institutionalized. And basically they got ripped off by a vanity publisher who published like 5 copies of it, like gave them 2. And, like, of course, David Tibet gets one because he's like a freak who has like every book. Although he's like kind of parting out his collection. I got a couple of his here, which is pretty cool. But yeah, like that was like beyond obscure, but he reprinted it. He's done these beautiful, amazing editions. A movie was made about it. MIT Press did something about it. So like, but also like stuff like, you know, that Gift Now and, compilation that right. came out recently full of like amazing art,
yeah.
noise writers and occult, right. all sorts of things. Not a ton of copies of that as far as I know. So the kind of thing where like, let me get a couple of these myself and I don't rip people off. I'm just trying to make sure like you can get these things in America.
Right.
Yeah. Part of it. Like, recently Metastases in France did a repress of something I had been obsessed with for years. This huge occult calendar. And it's just, it was from like the 1880s, shockingly beautiful, incredible in printing and engraving. The edition is 777. I think it's mostly sold out. I think you can get it from them. Ajna Offensive in the U.S. had a couple. We talked about it. But, like, it's... Yeah, I mean, it costs money to print books. And
yeah.
people with a real esoteric taste probably can't...
If you'd like to continue this episode, you'll need to subscribe at patreon.com/whitecentipedenoise. Once you do, you'll get access to the full version of this episode, as well as WCN-TV episodes and a wide range of bonus noise content. White Centipede Noise Podcast is made possible entirely by Scene support. You can support by subscribing at patreon.com/whitecentipedenoise.